Merci. Als die freundliche Einladung kam, vor dieser Würdigung und mir sehr lieben Gruppe von Studenten einen Vortrag zu halten, sagte ich sofort zu, obwohl das Thema mir etwas fremd war und fremd bleibt. Auch wurde ich leiser, aber mit Strenge befohlen, meinen Vortrag auf Englisch zu halten, da, wie unser lieber und kluger Freund Chung Su mir erklärte, die Tagung soll international sein. Aber Chung Su, erwiderte ich, wenn ich Englisch oder gar Amerikanisch rede, bin ich genauso international wie George W. Bush. Chung Su sagte, wer? Und so war alles entschieden. Der Vortrag wird auf Englisch gehalten, mit ein paar deutschen Texteinschübsen. Ach, wenn ich nur Koreanisch konnte. Aber selbst George W. Bush konnte sehr wenig Koreanisch, auch sehr wenig Englisch. Lassen Sie mich also unser Thema Frei sein und frei handeln aufgreifen, und zwar mit einem Hinweis auf Amerikanisierung. One of the most depressing signs of the Americanization of German life is the German sweatshirt, der Trainingspullover, or better translated, das Sweatshirt. Now the American sweatshirt sports letters front and back telling some of the crucial events in the intellectual life of the university student wearing it. For example, on the front, Yale University women's rugby team, and on the back, league champions, 1999. Nowadays, however, when Americans walk down the streets of a German city, they read the letters printed on German sweatshirts, and they are dumbfounded, because although the words are invariably in English, they make no sense whatsoever. For example, on the front, Yale Women's Rainbow Stars, and on the back, Winner Go Factory Days. Hello? Sie denken, ich übertreibe, aber einer von Deutschlands wichtigste Haute-Couturier, das Gebrüder Albrecht und Dieter, in einem neuen Prospekt, das ist natürlich kein Sweatshirt, sondern ein T-Shirt, aber da steht drauf, Chicago City, was es nicht gibt. Es gibt ein New York City, aber Chicago ist just Chicago. Chicago City, VE approved, V-E-V-E approved. That's Victory in Europe, 1945. So, Victory in Europe approved cheerleader. Since 1959, das Mädchen ist gut gepirkelt. Das alles macht keinen Sinn. Das werden Sie schon merken, wenn Sie Englisch können. Man liest, das muss aufhören. Aber it is a little known fact, but I have researched it in the crypt of the Jagiellonian Library in Krakow, and am therefore well informed about it, that Immanuel Kant once, but only once, donned a German sweatshirt with English words front and back, words which made no sense. As he stepped out of his house in Königsberg, it was 4 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon, and the prisoners next door were rehearsing for their Sunday chapel service. It was a sound Kant loved so well. The passers-by were astonished to see that instead of his usual frock coat slipping off his wretchedly sloping shoulders, Kant was wearing a sweatshirt that read on the front, "Intelligible characters do intelligible deeds." And on the back, a bright yellow smiley face and the words, "I can always get what I want," spelled naturally K-A-N. Now, this little joke comes from a musical, a Broadway musical, and later a film called Hedwig and the Angry Inch. And one of the things that happens in this film is that Hedwig is sitting on a hilltop giving a speech, a lecture, to an audience of one person. It's raining, this person's holding an umbrella, and Hedwig is giving a speech, She's angry, she or he, it's difficult to say, is angry about all kinds of things. And one of the things she's angry about is German philosophy. And in the middle of this diatribe, she suddenly shouts out, "You can't always get what you want." Okay. This is a very common American expression. When you're frustrated, I would say to you, "You can't always get what you want," but I would spell it C-A-N apostrophe T. But Hedwig says, "You can't always get what you want." And one of the themes of my Vortrag is that this is the greatness of Kant. He can always get what he wants, okay? Even if it's terribly cruel, the method that he uses to get it. And the first quotation is, of course, from the great man himself. It has to do with Schuld und Zurechnungsfähigkeit. So tadelt man nichtsdestoweniger den Täter. I love the alliteration. It's a beautiful, beautiful phrase, and I'll make reference to it a little bit later. Among the passers-by, as Kant was wearing this sweatshirt that says, "Intelligible characters do intelligible deeds," and on the back, "I can always get what I want," among the passers-by were three young students from Tübingen, roommates. All three of them admirers of the great man. They had come on a sort of pilgrimage from sleepy Swabia to far-off Königsberg. They read the letters front and back and were perplexed. The first, the most handsome and poetically gifted of the three, turned to his two companions and smiled wryly. "And you too were worried about my mental health," he murmured. The second, the most dour of the three, whom the other two had dubbed the old man, der Alte, did not seem to be excessively perturbed. "I can find a place in my system for this," he said, with his chronic stutter. The third and youngest, bright-eyed and brilliant, so much so that the other two called him Wonder Boy, seemed most excited of the three. "A place in your system," he cried. "It will have to be at the very summit of that system, or at the very basis, because the intelligible deed is the meaning of God." Each of the three was right, in a way. The dour old man was right because he could find a place in his system for everything, no matter how bulky or recalcitrant, except for those things he had to sweep under the rug when no one was looking. Wonder Boy was right because the intelligible character would prove to be the only possible bridge, barely viable, very shaky, connecting the finite and the infinite, and therefore closing the gap between the human and the divine realms. But the beautiful man who doubted Kant's sanity was the most perspicacious of the three, for the inscription on Kant's sweatshirt indicated that this paradigm of enlightenment, he who had ventured to put all past metaphysics, morals, and religion into their rationally constructed places, had gone stark raving mad. And right at the beginning, not at the end of his critical project, no one had noticed. As with most cases of madness, however, there was a method in it. The method was dictated by the need to assert freedom in the human order. Because Kant knew the complexities of all human action, he also knew that freedom would require a surreptitious exit from this world and an entirely phantasmatic entry into another impossible world. And so he broke all the rules of his own rational critique of metaphysics and postulated a time that was at no time, and a place that was at no place, and a deed that, while indeed a deed, was not merely one deed among others, but the deed, die Tat an sich, he called it, die Tat an sich, the deed that, like a Ding an sich, would decide once and for all the character of each one of the human beings that have populated the world since the emergence of mankind, not to mention womankind. Schelling was attracted to this idea of intelligible characters performing intelligible deeds in his astonishing 1809 Abhandlung. über das Wesen der menschlichen Freiheit. He was attracted to it because, I believe, he too could see how completely mad it was. It sought to bridge the two worlds, the Diesseits and the Jenseits, but only by means of an ass's bridge. Better, it was the kind of a wonky bridge portrayed in Monty Python's film, The Holy Grail, in which a vicious kobold or bridge spirit asks trick questions and poses unsolvable riddles in order to toss perplexed travelers who desire to cross the bridge into the abyss. Schelling's analysis begins calmly enough. Die Abhandlung. Die freie Handlung folgt unmittelbar aus dem Intelligiblen des Menschen. Aber sie ist notwendig eine bestimmte Handlung, zum Beispiel, um das Nächste anzuführen, eine gute oder eine böse. Vom absolut Unbestimmten zum Bestimmten gibt es aber keinen Übergang. Dass etwa das intelligible Wesen aus purer, lauterer Unbestimmtheit heraus, ohne allen Grund, sich selbst bestimmen sollte, führt auf das obige System der Gleichgültigkeit der Willkür zurück. Here the word Willkür is spoken or written perhaps for the first time in its modern sense, that of the arbitrary, fortuitous, gratuitous. From here it is only a tiny step to the question Schelling feels compelled to pose, namely that of the Wesen in dem Wesen. Such a doubling of Wesen indicates a problematic transition, indeed an impossible Übergang, into the unknowable beyond. The intelligible deed must be an eternal deed. It will have had to decide in a future anterior sense. It will have had to decide everything in einem magischen Schlag, in one magical stroke. That one stroke will have decided everything in a future anterior tense that seems to imply the circularity of time itself. The everything that will have been decided, Schelling remarks, in an extraordinary passage that I have never been able to understand, includes sogar die Art und Beschaffenheit seiner Korporisation. Die Korporisation des Menschen hängt davon ab, was für eine intelligible Deed in diese nirgendwo, nirgendwo stattfindet. If Hölderlin is the beautiful one, those blue eyes will have been freely chosen by him in that circular time before time. And if Hegel's style of delivery in the lecture hall will be flawed by a slight yet persistent speech impediment, that impediment mirrors some deeper flaw that marked and continues to mark him eternally in a space outside of space. And if Wonder Boy is unable to solve the riddle of evil without implicating God and all the stormy gods and raging goddesses that ever were, that too will decide in some accountable way Schelling's height and weight, or at least his stature in the world of philosophy, which, as you know, continues to grow. For Schelling is clear about what is truly at issue in the matter of intelligible characters doing intelligible deeds. His sole example, at this point in the text, is Judas Iscariot. And the issue is captured in the crucial word Zurechnungsfähigkeit, which falls here for the first time in the treatise. Madness, in other words, will involve the imputation of culpability. Is it not fascinating that the most beautiful of the three students, who wrote no essay on freedom or praxis of any kind, did compose an essay on punishment, über den Begriff der Strafe? Hölderlin's is a mere sketch, 3 pages long. But its recurrent theme is the circularity, the vicious circularity, of punishment and the moral law. I suffer punishment, and in my suffering know for the first time that I have somehow contravened the law. But I know the law only after having broken it. And because of this, I suffer unjustly, or perhaps justly, the circularity making it impossible for us to determine one way or the other. Perhaps the temporality of punishment, in Hölderlin's view, is the temporality of freedom, as Schelling describes it in his 10th letter. As the tragic hero is free only in an imperfect tense, proclaiming as he or she goes down, I was free. You'll remember that in the 10th letter. Die Freiheit des tragischen Helden ist immer imperfekt. Nicht, ich bin frei als Leidender. Nee, ich war frei damals, als ich noch lebte. Es ist nur im Sterben, im Verschwinden, kann man behaupten. I was free. For Schelling, that's the essence of the tragic in the 10th letter. And just so, for Hölderlin, I was at fault. I did deserve the punishment that I, who am innocent, received. Whether one can call this just deserts is dubious, inasmuch as, in Hölderlin's words, and these are the final words of the essay, all suffering is punishment. Jedes Leiden ist eine Strafe. But that seems cruel. My paper has 3 theses, if only because every philosophy paper needs theses, and at least 3 of them. First, philosophy in the form of a reflection on practical reason has no genuine interest in the freedom of the philosopher himself or herself. It has interest only in the freedom of others. Second, interest in the freedom of others has nothing to do with altruism, but is grounded in the need and or desire to assert imputability and accountability, Zurechnungsfähigkeit, against them. Third, the ground of this need and or desire, and hence the genuine interest of philosophy in freedom, is not justice, but cruelty. My 3 theses derive from my memory, itself admittedly a shaky bridge, of 2 philosophical texts. After Kant introduces the theme of freedom in the 3rd antinomy of the 1st critique, he takes 100 pages or so, actually over 100 pages, rhetorically the most gripping pages of the work, full of the wittiest sophisms, including the sophism he playfully calls transcendental subreption, to give himself back all the things that a critique of pure reason forbids him to think or to utter. Under the guise of claims made by practical reason, itself a sophism of the first order, he turns phrase after phrase in the surreptitious effort, for subreption is surreptition, Hinterhältigkeit, subreption means nothing other than that, to transcend all the self-imposed limits of his thought. I venture to say, this is me putting words in your mouth, I venture to say that every student here remembers her or his own internal struggles while pondering such phrases as, and these are phrases just culled from those 100 pages, ein regulatives Prinzip, dem Gegenstand angemessen, der praktische Begriff, intelligible Ursache, Kausalität außer der Reihe, eine Kausalität, die nicht Erscheinung ist, beizulegen. Eine Kausalität, die nicht Erscheinung ist, beizulegen. Den Charakter des Dinges an sich selbst. Zitat, den Charakter des Dinges an sich selbst. Noch ein Ausweg sei offen, sei gar nicht in Abrede zu ziehen, nicht vor unmöglich zu erklären, and so on, and so on, and so on. Why all this surreptitious, behind the back, abracadabra? Soon enough, Kant introduces the themes of punishment, accountability, and guilt. Freedom is but a corollary, a secondary principle to the principal axiom, namely that the need and the desire to punish are inexpugnable. Unentbehrlich is Kant's word. If kategoreo means I accuse you, ratio means I reckon you are guilty, and Vernunft means I apprehend you. So it is when Kant, in his apparently harmless commentary on the cosmological idea of freedom, gives us an example, ein Beispiel, of the intelligible character, the sole example. For after assuring us that the human being himself or herself is appearance, der Mensch ist selbst Erscheinung, Kant, with no apparent discomfort, for so it is with the mad, plants one foot firmly in appearances and the other, with all the grace of a man not well trained in ballet, in the intelligible realm of traditional religious and moral discourses. He gives us the example of a malicious liar who, no matter how constitutionally mendacious he may be, no matter how compelled by his or her very naturel to lie and to lie maliciously, needs to be punished as though his lies were freely told. So tadelt man nichts desto weniger den Täter, says Kant, in one of the most rhetorically powerful, alliterative, and witty sentences of the Critique. The rhetorical power deriving, I believe, from the projective character of the malicious lie of Critique itself. If the liar were a killer instead of a mere liar, Kant would no doubt announce, with still more glorious alliteration, so tadelt man bis in den Tod den Täter. Kant finally reveals what freedom is all about. His is a tale that Hölderlin, describing the murderous words spoken by a tragic hero or heroine, called tödlich faktisch. It is a tale of eines tödlichen Tadelns. How does the deadly tale unfold? The malicious lie, Kant says, is outfitted by you and me as rational creatures with its intelligible character, seinem intelligiblen Charakter beigemessen, so that we can declare that at the instant of the crime, in dem Augenblick, the liar or killer was, but now, because we have one foot gracefully coming down in eternity, the liar or killer is and forever will have been both fully free, völlig frei, and altogether guilty, gänzlich schuld. B. 583. As always in the Kantian text, the apparently innocent example by transcendental surreptition tells the malicious tale. My memory of a second textual event is that when Schelling advances from his astonishing freedom essay to the three grandiose drafts of The Ages of the World, Die Welthaupte, he drops the phrase in einem magischen Schlage, drops not only the phrase, but also the thought, and even the desire of the thought. One might describe this high point in Schelling's thinking, the summit of Die Weltalter, as the discovery that where essence is concerned, the strokes, die Schläge, are many, not merely one, and that they involve different intensities of languor, Sehnsucht. This in turn involving multiple sexual and gender identities for the essence, and multiple moods of languishing, schmachten, hence of implacable illness and eventual death. The magic never ends for the essence, but what comes to a stop is the one. What begins is the epoch of two or more, the du as. Schelling finds his 2 feet planted firmly in the realm of narrative, of the oldest stories told on earth. Narrative beyond the reaches of dialectic, already beyond good and evil, and hence caught up in what, after Nietzsche, we call the philosophy of the future. My sources today, however, are neither the surreptitious Kant nor the infinitely courageous Schelling, but Robert Musil and Jacques Derrida. I want to talk about Musil's figure, Moosbrugger, den Sie alle kennen, and about Derrida's penultimate seminar, which was on the death penalty, La Peine de Mort. Many years ago, I had a doctoral student, Professor Kelly Coble, who, working with Laura Huhn and me, Laura at that time was in Berlin, wrote a dissertation here in Germany on Kant, Schelling, Musil, and Ernst Mach. His thesis, entitled Inscrutable Intelligibility, analyzed the philosophical background of both the German Gesetzgebung and the American Criminal Code, especially where capital crimes are involved. So it was a dissertation on the law, really. Coble demonstrated that the philosophical presuppositions of our criminal codes, the German and the American, when it comes to the question of Zurechnungsfähigkeit in capital crimes, have not altered in any significant way over the years since Kant. And I include das Dritte Reich. Da ist keine Änderung. Weder vorher, während noch nachher. When it comes to culpability, accountability in capital crimes, nothing has changed. Coble argued further that the best philosophical analysis of accountability and imputability is found in an Austrian writer, one who earned a doctorate in philosophy, but who never wrote specifically as a philosopher, by the name of Robert Musil. I would like to work through with you the Moosbrugger chapters of Der Mann und Eigenschaften, because I accept the argument of Kelly Coble that there is no more incisive account of accountability in the literature. And I want to add to Musil's account a brief discussion of some aspects of Derrida's death penalty seminar. This may seem odd, inasmuch as Germany no longer practices the death penalty. Indeed, it may well be that the horrific history of 20th century Germany makes it the most sensitive of all European nations when it comes to the question of taking a life. Yet in a crucial moment of Derrida's seminar, he makes an odd appeal to a German word, one that he says marks the very future of the question of the death penalty. The American word cruelty dominates the first part of his seminar because of the US Supreme Court's interpretation of the phrase in the Constitution that forbids cruel and unusual punishment. The death penalty may be justified only if it is shown that there is nothing unusual about it, and if the method of death delivery can be deemed, if not kind, at least not cruel. Cruelty derives from the Latin word cruor, I bleed, as though quoting Shylock, prick me and I bleed, or blood flow in general. Yet Derrida argues in his seminar that even if the death penalty were to be outlawed in all the states, including even Texas, a certain form of cruelty would continue unabated. And that form, he says, is represented best by the German word Grausamkeit, which has no reference to blood flow, but to grauen, as in grauenerregend, grausig, grauslich, gräßlich, greuel, derived, the dictionaries tell us, from a specifically German word, ein urdeutsches Wort, namely the Middle High German grüven, related perhaps to the Old Slavic word grudu, which the dictionaries translate as schauderhaft, something that sends a shiver or a shudder up and down the spine. Surely, what intrigues Derrida about Grüven, about this shudder, is its undecidability, for it seems to refer to both death and destruction and the excitements of Eros. Feeling groovy? Grausamkeit, Greuel, and Grüven have a long and fascinating history in German literature and in folk dialects. And when one thinks of the related words, Gram, Grimm, Groll, Griesgram, and even, dare I say it, Grell, the story becomes infinitely complex. Why is Derrida interested in this ambiguous and perhaps even undecidable Grausamkeit? Because, he says, of the state of the soul of psychoanalysis today. If psychoanalysis is to have a future, it must pursue what Freud calls die Todestriebe, the death and destruction drives, in the direction of the human and perhaps also animal need or desire to practice cruelty and inflict pain and horror. On whom? On the others, yes, but perhaps also, and here once again, seemingly undecidably, on oneself. If psychoanalysis has failed to make much headway beyond the pleasure principle, and therefore has failed to keep up with the world in which you and I live, have the philosophers done much better? Not a single philosopher among the greats of our tradition, from Plato through Heidegger, has argued philosophically against the death penalty. Some were against it, but no one has argued, Derrida claims, philosophically against the death penalty. All have come down on the side represented, perhaps most recently, by Carl Schmitt, who tells us that fraternity and friendship are grounded in the insight that one always has enemies or foes, and that it must be really possible, real möglich, for these foes to be physically killed, physisch getötet. Grausam, you may say. Yes, feeling grüven. Moosbrugger, for one, agrees with the philosophers. For the procession of women who accost him in the suburbs and in the dark alleyways of Vienna are his enemies, his foes. They want something from him, something he's not willing to part with. And his only defense is to destroy them, to remove them physically from the scene. From the moment Musil introduces us to Moosbrugger's cheerful face, Zitat, gutmütige Kraft und der Wille zum Rechten sprachen aus seinem Gesicht. We know that Moosbrugger, Kant, and the rest of us are in trouble. Musil's sentences begin very sanely, but by the time we arrive at the final verb, the famous final German verb, we flounder in the realm of madness. These sentences are so cruel that I shall leave most of them to your own morose delectation. I will cite only a few of them. Let it be said as straightforwardly as possible. Whereas Moosbrugger's behavior is blatantly insane to all who observe it, for Moosbrugger himself, such behavior expresses a stronger and a higher feeling of his ego and of his reason. Sein ganzes Leben, schreibt Musil, war ein zum Lachen und Entsetzen unbeholfener Kampf, Geltung dafür zu erzwingen. Moosbrugger hates the psychiatrists who use Latin and French words to debase his character, turning the mystery of his difficult life into a series of everyday categories. He works against his own defense attorney and in favor of the presiding judge precisely because he wants to have his intelligible character, his dignity. As Musil will later say of him, quote, translated into English, Moosbrugger did not believe in God, but rather in his own personal reason, Vernunft. True, his reason fails to hold things together. Why? Musil explains, in the most profound sentence of the book, die Gummibänder waren einfach weg. Die Gummibänder waren einfach weg. Earlier on in the novel, Musil tells us about the trial. In der Verhandlung bereitete Moosbrugger seinem Verteidiger die unvorhersehbarsten Schwierigkeiten. Er saß breit wie ein Zuschauer auf seiner Bank, rief dem Staatsanwalt Bravo zu, wenn dieser etwas für seine Gemeingefährlichkeit vorbrachte, das ihm seine würdig erschien, und teilte lobende Zensuren an Zeugen aus, die erklärten, niemals etwas an ihm bemerkt zu haben, was auf Unzurechnungsfähigkeit schließen ließe. Sie sind ein drolliger Kauz, schmeichelte ihm von Zeit zu Zeit der die Verhandlung leitende Richter und zog gewissenhaft die Schlingen zusammen, die sich der Angeklagte gelegt hatte. In den Augen des Richters gingen seine Taten, Moosbrockers Taten, von ihm aus. In den seinen waren sie auf ihn zugekommen wie Vögel, die herbeifliegen. Für den Richter war Moosbrugger ein besonderer Fall. Für sich war er eine Welt. Und es ist sehr schwer, etwas Überzeugendes über eine Welt zu sagen. Recall it for Kant. Freedom is a causality that falls aus der Reihe, outside the chain of causation in the space and time of nature. Moosbrugger is in this respect too a paragon of Kantian freedom, because for him every event in his life, without rubber bands, falls aus der Reihe. Interestingly, Musil invokes not nature, but the more phenomenological notion of world, indeed a world that resists categorization. In that world, the diachronic form of intuition, the portal that grants entry into an orderly inner experience, is reduced to synchronic anarchy. With Moosbrugger, everything is nebeneinander, even if it ought to have been nacheinander. All the birds of a feather flock together, the kaleidoscope of his mind turns constantly. The psychiatrists call the results of this disorder of mind hallucination. Moosbrugger knows, of course, that he hallucinates. But he also knows that we others are not perspicacious enough to see the visions and to hear the voices that he hears. He is so much better at hallucinating than we are, or than the psychiatrists are, that we and they have nothing to say to him. Doubtless, Moosbrugger wants to be as intelligible as his worthy judges, and his judges help him in this endeavor. Working together, Tita und Tadlanda elaborate the logic of his death sentence. Of course, that sentence is appealed, for everyone can see that even though this socio-psychopath needs to be locked up or somehow kept at bay, he is as mad as a hatter. And whether one lives in Austria or England or America, one must never kill a mockingbird, even if his song is insane. Moosbrugger's case goes to the forensic psychiatrists, who, as usual, contradict one another, and ultimately to the forensic lawyers, the experts on Zurechnungsfähigkeit. Eine Fußnote. Unter den allerersten Juristen, die über die Zurechnungsfähigkeit von verrückten Menschen entscheiden mussten, war der Kammersgerichtsrat E.T.A. Hoffmann, den Sie als Autor von den Nachtstücken, besonders von dem Sandmann, gut kennen. Sein Beruf war eigentlich, der war Richter. Und seine Spezialität war zu entscheiden, ob die Verrückten zurechnungsfähig sind. Er scheint also in der Gesetzgebung auch eine literarische Tätigkeit. Wir haben Musil und Hoffmann. Das wäre ein sehr schönes Thema für eine Dissertation, denke ich. Da ist sehr, sehr viel auszugraben. Die Grenzen also zwischen Fiction und tödliche Faction. Okay. Deadly Facts, Deadly Factuality und Fiction. Als ob die Juristen in irgendeinem Augenblick den Schriftsteller brauche. Wieso denn? Warum? The father of Musil's hero, Ulrich, is the preeminent expert in Zurechnungsfähigkeit of his day. The reader is happy to leave Moosbrugger's wild world, his insane world, behind in the hope that something better awaits. But of course, you know that Ulrich's father is crazier than Moosbrugger. As a lawyer, he invents all of these fantastic reasons why one has to take Moosbrugger's life. And Musil's great skill, his geschick, his incredible skill, is to show us that these two are on a par, Moosbrugger and Ulrich's father. The best, therefore, is to have no qualities. Okay. Lass die Eigenschaften den Vätern so. Ulrich's father, who has many qualities, is a theoretician of the law and a specialist in the question of the death penalty. As with any university professor, he has enemies in the academy, But even his enemies agree that the punishment of death must be carried out if a society is to survive. The logics of justification may vary, but the conclusion does not. Any rational creature with qualities seems to agree on this. One of the most unnerving aspects of Musil's unfinished masterpiece is the way in which the minds of Moosbrugger and his judges run along the same lines, so that when we are well into the book, we have a difficult time distinguishing the non sequiturs of jurisprudence from the ramblings of a lunatic. Immediately after Musil has given us a splendid show of Moosbrugger's hallucinatory mind, he takes us in chapter 60 on an excursion into the logico-ethical kingdom, Ausflug ins logisch-sittliche Reich. Doctors, lawyers, and the rest of us will all agree that Moosbrugger qualifies as someone whose accountability is diminished or reduced. Verminderte Zurechnungsfähigkeit would be this man, Moosbrugger's essential quality. Yet can or should the ethical good of responsibility, das sittliche Gut der Verantwortung, be diminished? Should or can it be diminished? Concerning the cases of diminished accountability, der verminderten Zurechnungsfähigkeit, Musil notes the following. Aus Kapitel 60. Bezeichnend für diese Unglücklichen, so Leute wie Musil, ist es, dass sie nicht nur eine minderwertige Gesundheit, sondern auch eine minderwertige Krankheit haben. Die Natur hat eine merkwürdige Vorliebe dafür, solche Personen in Hülle und Fülle hervorzubringen. Natura non fecit saltus, sie macht keinen Sprung, sie liebt die Übergänge und hält auch im Großen die Welt in einem Übergangszustand zwischen Schwachsinn und Gesundheit. Aber die Jurisprudenz nimmt nicht Notiz davon. Sie sagt, non dator tertium sive medium inter duo contradictoria. Zu Deutsch, der Mensch ist entweder imstande, rechtswidrig zu handeln, oder er ist es nicht. Denn zwischen zwei Gegensätzen gibt es nichts Drittes und Mittleres. Durch diese Fähigkeit wird er strafbar. Durch seine Eigenschaften der Strafbarkeit wird er Rechtsperson. Und als Rechtsperson hat er Teil an der überpersönlichen Wohltat des Rechts. Und dann ein bisschen weiter. Denn wenn man teilweise krank ist, ist man nach Ansicht der Rechtslehrer auch teilweise gesund. Ist man aber teilweise gesund, so ist man wenigstens teilweise zurechnungsfähig. Und ist man teilweise zurechnungsfähig, so ist man es ganz. Denn Zurechnungsfähigkeit ist, wie Sie sagen, der Zustand des Menschen, in dem er die Kraft besitzt, unabhängig von jeder ihn zwingenden Notwendigkeit, sich aus sich selbst für einen bestimmten Zweck zu bestimmen. Und eine solche Bestimmtheit kann man nicht gleichzeitig besitzen und entbehren. Es geht hunderte Seiten so weiter. Und ist völlig überzeugend. Wenn man Ü ist, ist es völlig überzeugend. Moosbrugger is no animal. He is by birth a subject of the logico-ethical kingdom. Und da also erst die Strafbarkeit jede Eigenschaft ist, die ihn zum sittlichen Menschen erhebt, wird es verständlich, dass der Jurist eisern an ihr festhalten muss. The psychiatrists, for their part, cannot agree on a diagnosis, whereas the teachers of jurisprudence can. Sein Zitat, das ich wegen der Zeit auslasse. Musil beobachtet, dass am Ende die forensic psychiatrists immer sie haben nie das letzte Wort, in keinem Fall, vor dem Gesetz. Vor dem Gesetz hat der Jurist das letzte Wort. Ob einer lebt oder stirbt, ob einer bestraft wird oder für unschuldig erklärt wird, das kann kein Psychiater machen. Der wird verhört, man hört ihm zu oder ihr zu, Aber entscheiden tut der Jurist. Und für den Jurist gibt es keinen halbverrückten Menschen. Ich würde sehr wünschen, dass dies heutzutage nicht mehr der Fall ist, aber einer von meiner besten Freunde in den Staaten heißt Lisa Rohn, die ist Psychiatrin und eine Forensic Psychiatrist. Sie ist ständig im Gerichtssaal, besonders wenn Frauen da, die immer in Mordfälle und wo eine Frau sich gegen den Mann sich verteidigt hat und so. Und sie gewinnt kaum einen Fall. Sie gewinnt kaum einen Fall. Und die ist eine tolle Psychiatrin. Sie war eine Studentin von mir, wir haben Merleau-Ponty studiert. Dann ging sie ins Medizinische. Dann wurde sie Psychiatrin. Sie ist anerkannt als einer der großartigsten in den Staaten jetzt. Aber sie sagte mir, sie gewinnt kaum einen Fall. Weil sie nie das letzte Wort hat. Das letzte Wort hat den Staatsanwalt und den Verteidiger. Beide Legal Guys. Es wäre besser, vielleicht ein Musel da. The doctors ultimately succumb to the jurists. For no one is willing to deprive Moosbrugger of the ethical good of responsibility. Even if the jurists in Musil's novel are reminiscent, very reminiscent of Senat's President Schreber in his least lucid moments. The detailed debate among the jurists is carried out in chapter 111, so much, much later in the novel. Time won't permit a discussion of this debate, in which all the arguments go in circles entirely reminiscent of Hölderlin's perceptive sketch über den Begriff der Strafe. This is the chapter in which the unfortunate relevance of philosophy and theology for jurisprudence is revealed most strongly. The chapter is called, in English, For a Man of Law, There Are No Half-Insane People. Es gibt für Juristen keine halbverrückten Menschen. The debate itself is both hilariously comic and, if one may say so, grausam. A few words now, by way of conclusion, on Derrida's penultimate seminar, taught over 3 years, 1999 to 2001, on the death penalty. Among the most controversial and least expected arguments Derrida raises in his seminar is one that touches on the kindness and the humanity of certain forms of execution. You will recall that Dr. Guillotin, that his invention was celebrated for its humaneness, for it eliminated the pain associated with death, reducing the transition from life to death to a fraction of a second. To sever the spinal cord so efficiently, and at least when the widow performed well, which she often did, it was certainly an improvement over the axe or the sword or the mace, not to mention fire at the stake, or a team of disagreeable horses. Who knows but that a certain thrill might be experienced at this ultimate instant in the arms of the widow, la veuve is what she was called in French, that a certain thrill might be experienced in the arms of the widow, something spine-tingling, as we say in English, about the final sensation of life, the eros of thanatos, as it were. Derrida writes, this text isn't published yet, so I have this by dishonest means, so I can't tell you where it's from. The guillotine, inasmuch as it is supposed to act instantaneously, would be what relieves pain, what puts an end to pain. One could say that it is a little like what is called in American English a painkiller. The guillotine, und weiter, Derrida, the guillotine is not just a killer, it's a painkiller. And it kills pain because, in a certain way, reducing time to an instant, to the nothingness of an instant, it kills time. In English, to kill time is to waste time. I'm just killing time. But Derrida says the death penalty is literally the killing of time. Derrida sees in this celebration of humaneness and humanity a strange desire at work, the desire to put an end to the finitude of human time by reducing the determination of that finitude to a split second. You will recall that the chorus of Oceanides ask Prometheus why Zeus is so angry with him. Did he not do something worse than merely steal Zeus's fire for humankind? Did he not commit some further outrage? Prometheus concedes, yes, he gave human beings a gift greater than fire, the gift that constituted their humaneness as such. He gave them something like an eternal deed or an intelligible character. What did he give us? He gave us the poison or the remedy, pharmakon is his word, the poison or the remedy of blind hopes, tuflas elpidas. Tuflas elpidas is what he gave humankind. Hopes that prevent our foreseeing of our death. The irony is stupendous. Prometheus, he who has titanic foresight, gives as his finest gift the lack of foresight. Schelling would have called it das Unvordenkliche. And that lack is what enables human beings to learn all the uses of fire, to develop all the cunning and all the know-how of technology and of culture, enabling them even to outsmart the gods themselves with bones wrapped in folds of fat, saving the best of flesh for themselves. All that cunning, all that insight is grounded in lack of foresight, in blindness. Heidegger says it simplest and best. The fifth of the existential qualities of our being toward the end is the certainty of death combined with the indeterminacy as to its when. What has Prometheus to do with the death penalty? The Titanic state, the state of Texas, as it were, grants to the mortal on death row the finest of gifts, if you happen to live in Texas, the gift of a determinate when. The finitude of human being is now reduced to the smallest particles of a bifurcated instant. As the bullet penetrates the encircled heart, as the noose snaps the spinal column, as the crystalline liquids flow through the plastic tubing and into the vein, one, two, three, bingo. It is as though the governor gives to the inmate the gift that he so desires for himself and for his or her spouse and children, the gift of knowing precisely when the transition from the here and now to the beyond occurs. And not by dint of an ass's bridge. Then and precisely then, and at no other time, once and for all, life is determinate. The eternal deed, the eternal commencement, the only truly intelligible deed worthy of a truly intelligible character is the gift of death. As Silenus urged us all long ago, die as soon as ever he may. Quickly. At that point and in that instant, the position of killer and killed are reversed. In a logic worthy of Moosbrugger or of Moosbrugger's judges, sovereignty gives the gift that lasts, the adamantine gift reserved for the very few, the elect, the gift of the end of finitude, the gift that the German language calls so beautifully, das Gift. Derrida calls this the phantasm of the end of finitude, the phantasm of putting an end to the principle of indetermination, to the incalculable chance whereby a living being has a relation to what comes, to the Zukunft, à l'avenir, das Zukommende, die Zukunft, and thus to some other event. The perversity of the death penalty, its infinite perversity, properly infinite and infinitizing, according to Derrida, its Moosbruggerian madness is the desire to put an end to finitude, to impose an end in a calculable place at a calculable time. By putting an end to life, the calculating decision affirms its power over time. It masters the future. It protects against the eruption of the other, de l'autre. Of course, it only seems to do all this. For this calculation, this power, this mastery remain a phantasm. It could even be demonstrated, says Derrida, that such a phantasm lies at the origin of phantasm in general. In Freudian terms, one might say that the phantasm of the end of finitude is a primal phantasm. Derrida's Freudian heritage is unmistakably present in his description of the dream guaranteeing the survival of the death penalty, even as the death penalty is everywhere abolished. This is the most perverse moment of his seminar. Even if the death penalty is abolished, Grausamkeit remains. And this Grausamkeit has to do with the phantasmatic aspect of human beings and perhaps animals, which seems implacable, unremovable. Derrida writes, or said to his students, since the phantasm of the end of finitude is at work in us all the time, even outside of any real scene of verdict and death penalty, since we cannot keep ourselves from permanently playing the scene of the condemned one whom we potentially are, the fascination exerted by the real phenomena of death penalty and execution has to do with its effect of truth or of acting out. When we see it actually staged, we project it as one projects a film or as one projects a project. We see in projection actually take place what we are dreaming of all the time. What we are dreaming of, that is what in a certain way we desire, namely, to give ourselves death and to infinitize ourselves by giving ourselves death in a calculable, calculated, decidable fashion. And when I say we, this means that in this dream we occupy simultaneously or successively all the positions, those of a judge, of judges, of the jury, of the executioner, the assistants, of the condemned one. Of course, and the position of one's nearest and dearest, the family, the loved or the hated ones, and that of the voyeuristic spectators, who we, more than ever, ourselves are. And it is the force of this effect of phantasmatic truth that will probably remain forever invincible, thus guaranteeing forever, alas, a double survival, both the survival of the death penalty and the survival of the abolitionist protest. End of quote. It is for purposes of this fantasy, perhaps, that we are phantasmatically free. Free so that we may find the others accountable and culpable, their guilt imputable, their punishment indisputably merited and to be carried out with iron necessity. If the others are free, it is perhaps so that I, sovereignly human, and marvelously humane as you know me to be, may find them responsible and, at least intelligibly, and that means eternally, reprehensible. That slight tingling sensation they will feel, quite briefly, contrasts in me to a shudder of explosive yet extended ecstasy, an ecstasy of both body and mind. And I will give my ecstasy the highest of names. I shall call it not cruelty, but justice. And speaking of justice, many moments ago I mentioned Nietzsche's name. I have not cited him here, yet each of you has recognized my thesis as his work in the second genealogical treatise. Allow me to conclude with one brief paragraph from Goethe's Dämmerung on the Four Great Errors, section 7. Die Lehre vom Willen ist wesentlich erfunden zum Zweck der Strafe, das heißt des Schuldig-Finden-Wollens. Die ganze alte Psychologie, die Willenspsychologie, hat ihre Voraussetzung darin, dass deren Urheber, die Priester an der Spitze aller Gemeinwesen, sich ein Recht schaffen wollten, Strafen zu verhängen. Die Menschen wurden freigedacht, um gerichtet, um gestraft werden zu können, um schuldig werden zu können. Folglich musste jede Handlung als gewollt, der Ursprung jeder Handlung im Bewusstsein liegend gedacht werden, womit die grundsätzlichste Falschmünzerei in Psychologicis zum Prinzip der Psychologie selbst gemacht war. Ich danke euch und euer Vertrauen.